This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. That song by Madness is known mostly for its head-bopping chorus. But if you pay attention to the words, it's all about all of the things that make a house a home. Kids getting into trouble downstairs, a mother who won't allow any mess to accumulate just in case someone pops around for a visit. It's about family life. And that's often what people come back to when they think about what makes the four walls and the roof over their heads more than just a structure. We're reflecting on what makes a house or apartment or yurt or dorm feel like home. You've been sharing your thoughts with us on our Facebook page, and you can also add to the conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211. What is home to you? That number again, 1-800-639-2211. Howard Mansfield is the author of a new book called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. He has spent a lot of time thinking about what makes a structure more than the sum of its parts. Howard, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Jane. It's good to be here.
Do you live in a place that feels like home to you?
Yes, very fortunate, too. My wife and I live in an old enough house, we say. It's actually the youngest house in our little neighborhood. The other houses were built after the American Revolution, and ours is like 1880 or so. And it's a very ordinary northern New England house, you know, big house, little house, back house, barn. But it has just wonderful qualities of being settled, of being connected to the outdoors, of having big trees. It has that great quality of, I think, the best places to live in offer us peace, silence, and dreams. And it has that quality to it, that quietness that we can enter into that allows us, the nothing much of home, the passing of time. Just so it's a question of life, not things, and not the greatest finishes and the best room. It's a question of being comfortable.
But it sounds like there is something for you to the structure that also contributes to that feeling, not just the fact that you and your wife are able to live together and in a place. It's partly about the place.
Yeah, you know, there is, and it's an interesting thing about older houses is that sometimes they reveal themselves slowly. This house, if you walk through, you say, yeah, it's a nice enough old house. But as you live in it, and as you see the changing of the light on the irregular plaster walls and puzzle over some of the repairs that are made in time, you realize what a good spirit the house has. And I think one of the mistakes that people make with older houses is too often going in sort of with the reciprocating saw running before they really let the house speak to them, before they kind of adjust to the house, before they really learn the lessons that that house could teach them about living in that place or the wisdom of the people who built it there. You know, there's really two mistakes people make with older houses. And one is you don't do anything and you lose the roof, you lose the sills. And the other is that you do too much. And we're living in an era, I think, where too many people are doing too much to houses and you're losing that essential spirit. Maybe the thing that brought them to the house in the first place. And it gets lost in the refinishing and in the spiffing up of things.
We asked people on our Facebook page what makes a house or what makes a building a home. And similar to what you're saying there a little bit, Patsy wrote in to say, my home is filled with the memories of my three children growing up in it. And because it was built in 1857, it still has wisps of former residence on occasion. And Sarah says, you know, I've always wondered why a house is a home until you leave it. Even if all of the furniture and paintings stay and you rent it out for a year or more, when you go back, it feels like someone else's place and not yours, despite your personal effects being in the house. And nothing has changed except for your presence. What do you think about that, Howard?
I think both those comments are spot on. You know, this idea of I think what you said, whisks of former residents or whispers of
former wisps lives. Of former lives, former residents.
Yeah, and you know, you can feel that. We felt that particularly. We had that terrible ice storm. I know you guys did Vermont as well in December of 2008, and we were without power for about 7 or 8 days. And what happened during that was that the house's older self, its pre-electric soul, essentially, emerged. Because then we were all of a sudden back around the Vermont Castings wood stove, hauling water in by the bucket because we'd lost our well. And, you know, the ordinary hum of the electric motors that you hear in the house, the refrigerator, the winking of the Wi-Fi lights, all gone. And what you were back to was that smell of wood smoke always, the sense, this is late December of the day, dying really early around 4 o'clock. And I just, it was a different spirit walking in the house. And we were again back around the hearth. And if you look at the way we've lived for thousands of years, The biggest change is that we used to live with smoke and fire. We lived around the campfire. For thousands of years, we lived by the campfire. And when we moved in the Middle Ages, you always read these great accounts that in these great halls, it's these big open smoky fires, and there's a bard declaiming by the fire or something. Then someone thought, let's put the fire under a hood. This took thousands of years to figure out. Then a big fireplace, and then a small fireplace that actually threw some heat. And then the fireplace went into a wood stove or a box, and then for most of us, it disappeared. And all of a sudden, the house had no hearth. It was decentralized. It was like a tent losing its central pole. And this starts to happen towards the end of the 19th century. And it really, you can read a lot of writers lamenting this and disorienting that. And that's one of the biggest changes, is that we no longer have a hearth-centered house. People often feel guilty about this sometimes in these laments over television and appliances. But it's a big change.
When you say it's a big change, do you think it affects how people feel about that idea of home or of family life if we're not centered around a hearth? I mean, doesn't every generation bemoan this idea of a cohesive family unit disappearing?
Well, perhaps. But it definitely, when you go back and you look at how people lived in houses of that era, particularly here in northern New England, you'd be down to one or two rooms that you'd really be heating. And the whole family would be around the old cook stove, often it was. And, you know, in that time, Dad would be fixing tools and Mom might be sewing and the kids doing homework. And it was like a long, long car trip through winter, in a sense. It was wonderful and it was terrible, depending on the family, depending whether you had a happy family or an unhappy family. But people were together. And you see this kind of decentralization go on over and over in the house. Comes the radio. Everyone's gathered around the radio to listen to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, what he called them, fireside chats.
Mm-hmm.
Then comes the television and the first TVs in the neighborhood. Everybody comes over to see Milton Berle on this, you know, it's kind of scratchy picture. And then pretty soon everybody has their own TV, their own computer, their own device, and they're completely off in their own rooms. And the same thing happens again in the car. Everybody used to kind of sit in the car, you know, on these long car trips, and, you know, that maybe there's one AM radio station, so you spend your time annoying your sister or your brother. Now you pass cars on the interstate, and the screens drop down in the back, and you see each kid plugged into it, you know, their video IV drop, or everybody's in their own iPad, depending. So people, again, technology decentralizes us. We seek essentially, I think, one of the classic American spaces is the cabin in the woods. So we keep repeating it over and over. The car in traffic is the cabin in the woods. The iPod on the city street is the cabin in the woods, always trying to get away. That's one typical American space.
Although some people would consider that home. You know, some people don't want to be around other people. And that cabin in the woods, whether it's a physical cabin or an earbud cabin, it is sort of that cozy space.
Yeah, of course, there's great freedom there as well. And you read that, going back to the account of the hearth, when people lost a hearth, you see that all the time as well.
Would you tell the story that you tell this in the book as well, and talk about Harriet Beecher Stowe and her sister who campaigned against cook stove? Because they just, her thoughts on this feel so kind of funny to us now, but it also is clearly something that she felt very, very strongly about, you know, this idea of open hearths going away, as you've talked about.
Oh, my God. The Stowes, that their book is just wonderful. And they go into rhapsodies about the open hearth, the fire. And they say, okay, the cook stove is more efficient. Okay, you're going to use less wood. But the hearth, that's the soul of the house, they say. And they go into these great accounts of, you know, freezing in their rooms, but coming in and being warmed up by the fire. And at one point they say, you know, Washington and his men at Valley Forge, they did not freeze that winter so that we could have our fires in little metal boxes. They believed in the open hearth. It was a belief with them. It was a belief with them. They were also very obsessed about ventilation and have all sorts of scientists about how many hogsheads of air you might vitiate in a day or something.
Huh. Yeah, I love that this is the American ideal, is we fought for open hearths, not cook stoves.
And you know, I think it's Edward Everett Hale's mother says, oh, you know, get off it. You didn't spend 8 and 10 hours over this hot stove. I love my anthracite coal cook stove fire. You keep your open hearth. This is so much better for me. So there's two sides to it, you know. You know, obviously he was up in his, someone else was keeping the fire for him, so he could be poetic about it.
Right, no kidding. It makes a big difference.
Nostalgic about it, however you want to, you know, put it.
We're talking about the essence of home today, what makes a building more than just a structure, what makes it feel like home to you. We've heard from many of you. Trudy says the mess, the pets, the love, that's what makes a house a home. James says the dynamics of a home in action are what makes a house a home. You can add your thoughts at vpr.net/Vermont Edition or call 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Howard, we had several people who wrote in talking about, you know, not having a home at all and what that causes them to reflect on about this idea of a structure being a home. The Champlain Housing Trust says, we think about what having the safety and security of a decent home means every day and what happens when that's missing. That's what drives us to do our work. Rachel in Huntington says, as a kid, my family was evicted twice and couch surfed or doubled up at least three times that I can remember. As an adult in Vermont, my landlord terminated my tenancy for no cause after I was too assertive about my rights. Decorating my apartment and others' homes is one of my favorite things to do, especially at the holidays. For me, the most important thing that would make my house a home would be not being able to be evicted for no reason at all. And Morgan in Montpelier says, being someone whose life experiences include having endured many arduous years living without permanent housing and having lived homeless for so long, one's sense of what it is that makes a place their home comes from less the type of structure or dwelling, as well as less from what the belongings and decor might fill it or dress it up with. Instead, it has much more to do with what one does within it and how one lives their life. Thoughts on that, Howard?
Yeah, well, that's an incredibly strong batch of experiences with homelessness. You know, there's a couple of aspects about that. When you look at what makes people feel secure in their home, and you look at why you don't want to go to a shelter in a disaster, it's this sense that you can have expansiveness in your home. There's a great French writer, Gaston Bachelard, who was beloved by the French, wrote this wonderful book called The Poetics of Space. And he says, a good home is a good place for daydreaming, for reverie, for letting your imagination go, for free associative thinking, if you want to think of it that way. In other words, it's the way we enter the universe. It's the way we experience time. It's the way we're free to be ourselves. And when we have that feeling, then we're really most at home, and then we feel secure, and then we feel that ability, as I said, to experience peace, silence, and dreams. And when we lose home, it just decenters everything in our lives. I went down to New Orleans, did a little bit of work for Habitat after Katrina, and this is 18 months after Katrina, and the level of disaster was amazing. And then I went over to the Gulf Coast, and this little city of Pascagoula, Mississippi, just a beautiful place. 90% of the city had been covered by waves coming in. The devastation was amazing. But to be in that place was to be someplace where trying to go home again was front of mind with everybody. It was such a strong feeling, and you realize it took so much to put that back together. I mean, a lot of us have had times when maybe we've had an illness or lost a house or lost a job or had car problems. But imagine all that happens to you and your neighbor and your neighbor and your neighbor so that you've lost your community. And it takes so much longer to put that back together than we tend to want to acknowledge. So the Housing Trust, the Champlain Housing Trust that you mentioned, they seem to be there totally centraled on. They're totally correct about the importance of dwelling.
When you went down to the Gulf Coast, I think you tell a story as well about being with a photographer friend and seeing people mowing their lawns when they didn't have a structure around the lawn. There was no house, but there was still some sense that this is my home, this is a part of my identity, I'm still going to take care of it, even if the actual structure itself isn't there.
Yes, I went down there to see Annie Card, who's a professional photographer in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and she went down right after the hurricane with the Red Cross. She was a Red Cross volunteer, and, you know, doing that immediate Red Cross relief that we always see in the news. And then after that, she looked around and said, oh, my God, there's so much more here that needs to be done. So she and a friend co-founded a charity, a relief effort, to build 100 days, 100 homes in this poor neighborhood in Pascagoula, Mississippi.
Hey, Howard, so while you're telling this story, let me just tell you, Annie's actually calling in, so let's get her on the line, too, because she's here, and you guys can tell this story together. Hi, Annie. Nice to talk with you.
Hello. How are you?
Well, thank you for calling in. Howard was just, telling about this experience that you two had together.
Oh, my goodness. Well, hello. Yeah,
hello,
yes.
Mr. Howard.
Well, hi, Annie. So I guess, what you did down there was extraordinary, I thought, in that people needed so much. And the way you approached it was a great sense of pragmatic compassion, getting it done, getting the things that people needed into their hands as quickly as possible. Could you tell us the story of the houses we saw along Beach Boulevard and the fellow who mowed his lawn?
Oh, sure. It took me a while to understand, too, how people prioritize things after a disaster like that, when you lose everything. It was haunting after the hurricane, just a couple months after, when some of the richest companies in the country, rather than sending what people really needed and what they were asking for, which was a roof that they could sleep under rather than a FEMA trailer, or water that worked, or appliances and beds and things like that, truckload after truckload of Toys R Us and Walmart plastic stuff showed up. And bikes and things like that, and the people were grateful because they certainly didn't want to be written off in the press anymore as having been thankless and ungrateful. But they said, "Why don't people understand? We don't have deodorant, we don't have soap, we don't have laundry facilities." So it was, I think, the way to help people. What they taught us was, to listen to what they need and what they want. And it's very basic. Howard calls it dwelling. To them, a house was just a place that they could sleep and take care of their children and hopefully get clothes for their children to go to school. And so we really just tried to do the basics like that. And the home is place, too. I learned from Mississippians, they love their weather, they love their food, they love their coastline, they love their pecan groves, and they did not want to move. They wanted to stay there and rebuild their lives with their neighbors and in their churches and in their schools. And I had been there nearly a year and a half when Howard came, and it was very interesting. He was asking all these questions, and I thought he was going to write about all these people's stories. He has such a way of seeing people's pain or their purpose and a way how we can all help each other.
Well, Annie, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts. Howard, this sounds like this experience sort of distilled in some ways what having a home and creating a home means.
Yes, it was the essential thing in front of mind of everybody, and the obstacles in front of it, which I call in the book the storm after the storm, is what Miss Annie taught me, is that you could look at somebody and think they're okay, but it turns out they're going through a heck of a lot, whether they feel like they failed their family because they lost everything in the storm, or whether they're having to put up family members. It's a very tough thing to go through. But really, when you come down to it, it's the essence of dwelling. It's of being in a place, heart and soul. It's having that connection to a place. It's loving everything about it. And that place was quite special. I mean, just a lot of different things about it really struck me just in my short visit.
We are talking today about what makes a home, and we're hearing from some of you about what home means and what it feels like and how the structure that you live in can contribute to a sense of home, but also what else makes it feel like something that is crucial to your existence. Lab says, I was touched by the comment that what makes a home is not being evicted from it for no reason. I've never had the experience of eviction. I feel terrible just to be locked out for half an hour. And Stephen in Morrisville says, we've gone back to the era your guest is talking about. We were talking about open hearths earlier. And Stephen says, although we live right in the village, we use a wood-fired cook stove to cook and heat a good portion of our 19th century Victorian home, something I've been doing since 1974 in various places. Seeing, feeling, and smelling that fire is so important to us. The work is immense. Sometimes the fire is scary, but the direct contact with fire means so much. And listeners, again, you can add your thoughts on our Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house with two cats in the yard. Life used to be so hard. Now everything is easy 'cause of you.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking with the writer Howard Mansfield, who lives in Hancock, New Hampshire, about what makes a home more than just a space we occupy. Is home a feeling? Is it something we do to our space to make it physically, psychically, emotionally appealing? Is it about who lives with us? Tell us what you think makes a place and a space home. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Julie says, to me, home is a refuge for myself and those I love. It's a personal space reflecting the soul and life of those who live here. For me, that means filling the space with beautiful and comfortable things that connect me to family and bring me joy and comfort. It means flowers in the garden and soft rugs underfoot. It means old furniture and art connected to places and people I love. Cats on the bed, dogs underfoot, a winter fire in the wood stove, or a summer rocker on the porch. Somehow these eclectic things come together. People always comment on warmth and coziness in the places that I've lived. And Jennifer says, though, I don't think decor has much to do with my house feeling like a home. Sure, the pictures of my kids on the wall remind me that this is our family's home, but without their physical presence in the house, it wouldn't feel like a home, no matter how many pictures there are. We make memories there. Christmases, birthdays, family dinners. I could have nothing in my house, no furniture or fixtures, and it would still feel like home as long as my loved ones were there to share it with me. And let's go to Barbara, calling in from Guilford. Hi, Barbara, go ahead.
Hi, how are you, Jane?
Well, thanks.
Good. Yeah, my home is my home because I built it from the ground up. I put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into it, and I love it. You know, I wouldn't want to live anywhere else other than Vermont. And I'm just nestled in the woods in these mountain hollows and just, you know, stepping outside at night and looking at the sky and then looking back at the house and saying, I built that. You know, and we took a lot of the rock around the yard and the house and everything, and we just incorporated it right into the house. So it's pretty much a real natural house, and our wood stove pretty much heats up our house. That's what we mainly use to heat the house. And we cook on it, too, you know. I mean, save a little bit of the electricity bill, you know.
Yeah, Barbara, that sounds wonderful. Your own house, you built it. It's got your blood, sweat, and tears. Howard, you have some interesting thoughts on that because, you know, at least for Barbara, having put all of that sweat equity into the house makes it feel like hers. It's more than just, you know, sticks and stones. But you've also found that building a house can be a really detrimental process to a sense of family, at least for some marriages.
It's surprising how often you show up and you find people have built a wonderful house, but now they're divorced. It's just a very stressful thing for a lot of people. Decisions have to be made. The money clock is ticking. Maybe disagreements that hadn't been in their lives are now just laid bare by the pressure of making these decisions and building a house. And maybe they didn't have that agreement to start with about what they had wanted to build.
On the other hand, you know, obviously for many people, building that house, that idea of what you want your home to be can really be just a thrilling part of finding a space that feels like it's a part of you.
Yeah, it's a dream of a lot of people. I want to kind of go back to what Barbara was saying because I think she really hit something essential, and one of the things that we respond to older places, it's that the house, the land, and the people, they're on the same page. They seem to be breathing at the same rate, and places where people are happy, it's as if they're like recreated anew each day, whether by people planting or cooking or being there. But the house and the people are breathing at the same rate. There's a rightness there. There's a real fit there.
Let's go to Sally, one of your neighbors calling in from Hancock, New Hampshire. Hi, Sally. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a big fan of this book, and I've read it a couple of times. I think anybody who owns a house, is getting a house, is moving to a house should have it. And in it, one of the things that you say is that you've been to houses where everything seems to be right, and the way you put it is husband loves wife, cat loves dog, tree loves house, house loves view. I wonder if you could talk about the way a home, a house settles in the land, its relationship with the land, because it seems to me that with so many houses that seem that they've just dropped out of the sky and lodged who knows where, it's something that people are losing track of, architects are losing track of. Could you talk about that?
Sure. Thank you, Sally. Old houses and modern houses that are well-sited are just brimming cups of here. We are just there. We have a lot of, we're losing track. We have a lot of digital scatter in our lives where we're here and there. And what we respond most to places that we feel most alive in is that we feel a connection there. Those places, we feel their here-ness, almost, you could say. That's certainly one aspect of it.
Howard, why did you call your book Dwelling rather than Home? It's called Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Oh. What does dwelling mean to you?
Dwelling is an old-fashioned word that we've lost track of, I think. You don't really hear it anymore. You hear a lot of talk about houses and real estate and all that, and that's really beside the point. When we live heart and soul, we dwell. When we're connected to a place, we dwell. When we say this place is our place, then we're dwelling. And it's when we feel that possibility, the possibility that our lives can be enlarged, the possibility that we'll be a better person in that place, that's when we're dwelling. So it's a question of soul. It's a question of finding the soul, the shelter. It's a question of expressing the better aspects of our lives.
Let's go to Ishana calling in from Burlington. Hi there. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just want to say a couple things. Thank you so much for this topic. I love my little apartment in Burlington. And what makes it home for me is grinding my own flour on an old-fashioned mill by hand and just doing things as I like to say work-intensive, but it's love-intensive. It's putting things on the wall that I made, that my children made, and being close to the land by using fibers that are local. It's all very familiar to me, this kind of connecting to place through what is in the place already and bringing that into my being and who I am.
So does that mean for you it's more about, you know, what you're able to do and where you live in terms of a geographical space than the actual building that you live in?
If I had the funds in my dream world, I actually have notebooks full of houses that I've designed. And they're all about place. They're all about which way the hills face and where the woods are and what kind of plants can grow there, what kind of rocks live there. So it is about place.
Hmm.
It's about the land and what the land can give, and I love structures that feel comfortable on the land and don't look like they were just plopped there, like the woman before said.
Thanks so much for your call. Appreciate that. Howard, what about the idea, can you make a home out of any structure or any place you live?
I think certainly you can, whether you're an apartment dweller or you're living in a yurt, or you certainly can. And I think the caller, Ishana, I think she said, she hit the essential thing when she said where the hills face. This is a most neglected thing. Many architects will tell you, where's the house facing? People don't seem to think about siding the house. Often you'll see these home decor shows and people go in and they never say, well, where's this house facing? Where's the sun going to be when we're having breakfast? Where's it going to be when we come home at night? You know, what's it going to feel like to be here? Instead, they're too focused on appliances and surfaces and so-called upgrades. And it's a question of life and not things. And I think a lot of your callers have gotten right at that.
Well, we got a note from Andrew who says, we enjoy playing music together most evenings, fiddle and guitar, and weekly or so with other friends, either in our home or theirs. We are rank amateurs at best, but the warmth and friendship of those activities are a significant contributor to the sense of home as opposed to just house. And let's go quickly to Cynthia in Calais. Hi, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to say, of course, home is where your heart is, and I've lived in many apartments growing up and becoming an adult, and they were home, too. But what I live in now is a really radical, futuristic home. It's a 28-foot geodesic sphere, an attached 32-foot dome, which my husband built. He's sort of a scholar in geodesics, and part of that is because he believed in Buckminster Fuller's concepts of doing more with less and not having a mort gauge, a death gauge, or a mortgage. And so we couldn't get a mortgage for what we wanted to build because it had never been built and was radical. So we built our home late. In our lives, not late, but, you know, we weren't young. And that's allowed us to have a home economy, you know, meaning gardens, cooking, a small homestead.
So, Cynthia, you know, it's so interesting what you're saying that, you know, it can be any structure. And for so many people, it's different kinds of structures. What one person says is home is not going to feel like home to somebody else. But it's a wonderful thing that we have so many different ideas of home. And Howard Mansfield, I want to thank you for helping facilitate this discussion about what home is, what dwelling means, what kinds of architecture contribute and detract from those feelings. It's really wonderful to have you on the program.
Well, thank you, Jane. I really enjoyed being here and talking with everybody. Quite enjoyable.
Howard Mansfield lives in Hancock, New Hampshire, and he's the author of the book Dwelling in Possibility, Searching for the Soul of Shelter. Coming up, using the skills of the moderately computer literate around the world to help disaster workers in the Philippines with open source maps. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When natural disasters strike, some people sometimes feel hopeless to help, watching from afar, wanting to do something, but not really sure what would actually make a difference. This week, a group of Vermonters have marshaled those feelings for victims of Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines and applied their computer skills to the task of helping them. Their work is focused on providing digital maps to the affected region to aid workers who are on the ground. Here to explain more now is Bill Morris, one of the volunteers who've been coordinating some of this effort in Burlington. Bill, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
So the idea behind this effort is that relief workers on the ground in the Philippines need to have a sense of the geography they're traversing, need to know where roads are, need to know where villages are. Aren't those maps available everywhere around the world by now?
Yeah, you'd think so by now. No, actually, there are big swaths of the world that don't have mapping in a form that is immediately useful in a situation like this. So the sort of map that we think of as being able to get a person from point A to point B is sort of the thing you expect to see on Google Maps on a mobile device, you know, routing with turn-by-turn directions. And in the case of the Philippines, there certainly are maps in existence of the entire country, but they tend to exist in a paper form, sort of similar to the USGS topographic maps we have in this country. Which
you mean
makes
like a
it
big, huge map. That
yeah,
you go
certainly.
Somewhere to get.
Yep, and there might even be scanned versions of those available, but it's just not something that's immediately useful to a responder in the field, and it's not something that updates as quickly as is necessary.
So, is there Google Earth? Is there that sort of satellite mapping system of all of these places that if you just had your smartphone and were able to connect to a network, you'd be able to use it no matter what?
Yeah. So a bit of background on the OpenStreetMap project is it's basically the it's referred to as the Wikipedia of maps, where basically anybody can use their own expertise or the aerial imagery they have available to add and update features on a global digital base map. Ultimately, the goal is to have the entire world mapped, and it's a completely open source project, so the data is free to anyone who wants to use it. This is sort of in contrast to Google Maps, who provide their own updates and some limited crowdsourced updates. updates, but they don't allow free access. And actually, in a lot of cases, Google Maps coverage isn't as robust as OpenStreetMap. And particularly now in the Philippines, now that we've been working there, there's sort of a big contrast between the two. So what we want is something that's readily available to responders on the ground with minimal friction.
I'm talking with Bill Morris, who's a volunteer with the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team. And so what you do in this project is you get these maps from the OpenStreetMap team, and then all of these volunteers in Vermont and elsewhere, what are you actually doing with the maps?
So we get aerial imagery from a variety of sources, and in most cases it's fairly detailed, like down to, you know, you'd be able to see a car on the ground, the sort of thing you're accustomed to seeing in Google Earth, really. But Microsoft, in this case, has actually licensed their high-resolution imagery for OpenStreetMap use. So what somebody in, say, the mapathon we had on Saturday would do is just pop open the OpenStreetMap editor on their computer, and then they'll begin to trace roads, buildings, anything that's visible on that imagery. And that's a way that a person who's not familiar with what something looks like on the ground can still contribute to creating this robust geographic context for the people who are on the ground.
So you're taking that satellite imagery, and when you say tracing, you really mean you're tracing it so that it looks less like a satellite feature map and more like a traditional map, but that has some structures and buildings.
Exactly. And, you know, not tracing with a pencil, you're using your mouse and clicking along the lines. But what that does by translating it from just a raw image into a series of lines and networks, that makes it available to somebody. Actually, what's been amazing as we've interacted with folks who are on the ground, the first responders from Red Cross and from Doctors Without Borders and from the UN, we now have the infrastructure with OpenStreetMap to update the map on our end in Burlington. And as little as an hour later, somebody in the Philippines can download that in a format that goes directly onto a GPS and can be used to get turn-by-turn directions somewhere. So the real value that we're seeing in this is somebody here completely removed from the Philippines is able to assist somebody who, you know, for example, is trying to drive a truck of water to some remote village and now has a way of getting directions to do that.
And you're able to verify that that's actually happening with these maps that you are making?
Yeah, obviously, you know, the Red Cross, the other responders, they're the folks who are doing the real work here. They're so it's not their highest priority to immediately tell us how the data's been valuable. But we've been in good contact with our partners there, and they've been giving us, you know, some photos of the maps in use, some anecdotal stuff. And as soon as things calm down a little, we'll have a better sense of the numbers as to what specifically was valuable.
Is there enough of a robust network and satellite network and Wi-Fi network in the Philippines right now that those maps that you're working on can be downloaded?
Yes. In hard-hit areas like Tacloban, it's probably, you know, a member of the public is not going to have the Wi-Fi bandwidth to do that. But the aid agencies who are responding have the capabilities to do so. So with the devices that they're deploying to the field, Red Cross the UN Office of Coordination for Humanitarian Affairs, they're sending, you know, preloaded tablet devices, preloaded GPSs, and, you know, huge paper map printouts of the updates that we're making. So those, you know, tangible objects make it to the people in the field who need them.
Can you try to make this really concrete for me and give me an example of, you know, somebody you mentioned who's driving a truck to try to get relief supplies, water and other supplies to a village that's been hit by this typhoon? How does having your map help?
So previously, somebody, let's say somebody from Doctors Without Borders has a series of supplies that they need to get to a village they know the name of. Some locals might be able to give them some directions, but even those folks haven't seen the full extent of the access to that location since the storm hit. So what we're able to do is look at the the road to get to that location as it was before the storm, and we're able to look at it afterwards and to be able to say, okay, that bridge is out. They need to route around this location. That particular, there's all sorts of debris on the road there, need to route around there. And that's the sort of up-to-the-minute data that we can provide that is definitely helping out the folks on the ground.
So you're actually using images from before the storm and after the storm to be able to say what's going on the ground right now.
Yeah, there's really two components. The base mapping is what we started with, and that actually started before the storm hit because we could tell it was going to be bad. So just a sense of where all the populated places are, starting to get down house locations, things like that. Then 5 days after the storm hit, the International Charter on Space and Disasters was activated by the UN, which meant that all these commercial imagery providers could start providing imagery for free. And we've started using that to compare and to see which areas are hardest hit, where damage is, down to the road level, down to the house level. And just having the ability to do that with, you know, over 1,300 volunteers have helped us out with this, and it's a little unprecedented. But that kind of power has been really useful at all stages of the response.
This is something that is fairly familiar work to you in the sense that you already work in the field of digital cartography, but it's not necessarily something that you have to either be a coder or a map maker to be able to volunteer and do.
No, and that's what was great about the mapathon on Saturday is that the folks who showed up were across the spectrum. We had, you know, professional GIS analysts, and we had, you know, actually an entire family showed up to help us out. Folks who had, you know, had never drawn lines on a map before. And if you happen to be a good developer and you have some time available, we can definitely use some help with the tool building itself. But the real work of tracing and getting damage assessment, that can be done by anybody with a computer.
And that was what the purpose of this mapathon was on Saturday, to train people up in how to do this.
Yeah, to try and get as many people up to speed as quickly as possible. And I know that I don't have hard numbers, but I think about half of the folks there have continued to map, at least if I've read the stats correctly. So we had 14,000 individual features digitized that day. So that's houses, segments of roads, all sorts of stuff like that. And then that work is continuing. Like I said, this has been sort of unprecedented. The Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team really got its start in the aftermath of the Haiti earthquake, and a large number of volunteers helped with that. And that was fantastic. That showed the value of this tool to aid agencies worldwide. But what's unprecedented about this is we've never had this many people contribute this many edits in this short of a period of time. So I think we're still trying to wrap our heads around the possibilities.
How many people showed up to the mapathon in Vermont?
It was 21 that recorded individual edits that we could measure. I think there were probably more than that, but I actually lost track because I was too busy trying to get everybody oriented, which was awesome. There were actually about a dozen other events that happened that day worldwide.
Yeah, this was the Vermont contingent here, but then there was also a contingent in Nicaragua. There were things happening all over the world to try to get people involved in this.
Yeah, everybody was pitching in as best they could. And that's the part of the strength of the Humanitarian OpenStreetMap organization is that, you know, it's worldwide. There's always somebody online, always somebody willing to help and answer questions.
I understand you got started in this just about a year ago. What inspired you?
Yeah, it was. It had been on my radar since I started working with OpenStreetMap itself a few years ago. But the thing that inspired me to just like get on the Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team mailing list and start working was an earthquake in Iran back in August of last year, and the Red Crescent organization on the ground was looking for, you know, actionable transportation information. And I took a look at the system, saw how tasks were being sort of very, very methodically and efficiently divvied up and handed off to individuals to map locations. And I just thought, hey, this is fantastic. This is the kind of development work that you want to think is possible when you're doing development work in the field, that, you know, remote people can be of real use.
If people want to get involved, can they still get involved?
Certainly. Yeah, there are three active tasks on the task manager, as we call it, which relate to the Philippines. There's also one that Doctors Without Borders started for a section of Eastern Congo that's pretty hard hit by conflict and has even less base mapping than the Philippines. So there's... You know, the predictable nature of natural disaster, I think there will probably always be a certain amount of stuff to map. The goal would be great. You know, we want to have the entire world mapped. But I think things are constantly going to be changing, and the humanitarian work we can do this way is always going to be necessary. So the link that I saw you had on the website takes people directly to where they would need to start.
Good. And we do have that link up at vpr.net. Click on Vermont Edition. Bill Morris is a volunteer with the humanitarian OpenStreetMap team. He's been helping other volunteers in Vermont lend a hand to disaster recovery efforts in the Philippines. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that will do it for today's show. Tomorrow marks, of course, the 50th anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. The event is seared into the memories of people who were alive then, and it marks the beginning of a period of massive change in American politics and culture. We'll reflect on why Kennedy's assassination still casts a long shadow, and you can tell us what you remember about November 22, 1963. Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and join us tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.